And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, as the lady said. And I'm Phil Taylor, and Phil Conlon is away today. I asked him to do some research on Turkey, and I think he was thinking of drumsticks and perhaps started his research in a different area. I envy him. We're going to talk to David Jacobs, someone who's practiced law before an international criminal court. We're going to talk about a new book, which has been published by Baraka Books. And, of course, last week on the show, we spoke of one that's been published in London, taking up the matter of so-called international justice and tied in with large issues at the Security Council of the United Nations. For example, the emphasis now on the so-called Chapter 7, the responsibility to protect these courts, and that chapter seemed to go hand in hand, and now more and more lawyers and political figures around the world are raising the alarm about the manipulation or exploitation of this matter. And of course, later in the show, we will be talking to Mahdi Nazim Roya, who has written an important article for globalresearch.ca. I recommend it. It's called The March to War, Fighting ISIL is a smokescreen for U.S. mobilization against Syria, Iran, a very important article. And we'll be talking to Nazim at approximately 5:30. I'll just remind you, too, that next week on October 20th, we will begin our part in the membership drive. But you can be an early bird guy or gal, and we can do. You can go to CIUT.fm. And join now. And, of course, just make sure that you mention us. Just have to say selfishly. It's a great station, of course, and a lot of great programming. But anyway, at this hour, we'd like you to think about the Taylor Report, CIUT.fm, and you can do that. But we're joined now by David Jacobs. How are you, David?
I'm well, thank you.
Thanks an awful lot for joining us. I wanted to say that we're a contributor to a new book published by Baraka Books. People can go to that, barakabooks.com. Title is Justice Belied, The Unbalanced Scales of International Criminal Justice. It's edited by Sebastian Chartrand and John Philpott. They are the editors. Incidentally, the book is being launched on the 15th. David, tell me what... What's your take on the importance of the book or what it deals with? Because it's often said there are not sufficient books on the issue of 1994 Rwanda events called the genocide or the war or the massacres, etc. Many people say, well, we have various newspaper accounts, but there are very few books. So this is going to be one of the most important. Tell us why you think it's important.
Well, this book arose out of a conference that was held in Montreal a couple of years ago, which was looking at the practice of international criminal law, mainly from the side of people who are actually embroiled in it, basically defense lawyers, but also, quite importantly, from the point of view of Africans, who are kind of at the pointy edge of the experience of international criminal law. Mm-hmm. So it brought together a number of lawyers and scholars from around the world, and it's something we don't often hear about. I mean, our experience and our understanding of the situation, for example, in Rwanda and in other places in Africa, come almost exclusively from reports by Europeans and Americans, journalists, human rights people, and so on. So you don't often get to hear the perspective of Africans and people who have defended people who have been accused of war crimes and so on, and then tried and punished before these supranational courts that don't answer to any particular nation. But not formally, though, although arguably they do answer to the most important nations in the world, the U.S. and Britain and so on. Mm-hmm. So this conference brought together a number of people, and what you get in this book is a series of articles about international criminal law and what international criminal justice looks like on the ground from pretty important people, including Chief Charles Taku, who is a lawyer from Cameroon practicing in the United States. He has won a signal victory for one of his clients before the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda in front of the appeals chamber of the ICTR in the famous Military 2 case. I mean, setting the stage for the world to understand that the military leadership in Rwanda were generally acquitted of conspiracy to commit genocide, which kind of throws the general received wisdom about what actually happened in Rwanda into a cocked hat. Charles Taku has also appeared in front of the Special Court for Sierra Leone and the International Criminal Court regarding Kenya. So he's a very interesting guy, well worth reading. Also, Sir Rudasingwa, who was the Rwandan ambassador to the United States, Mexico, Argentina, etc., represented Rwanda at the United Nations, the World Bank, and so on. But he is now very important as a leading critic of the current Rwanda.
I didn't realize he's published in this. He has a text in this book.
Yes. He has a paper in this book, again, an important an important person. His paper is called "The Seven Challenges for Truth and Justice in Rwanda," and it's again exceptionally well worth reading. Mm-hmm. I could go on down the list. Leopold Nsengiyumva, who's a defense investigator in some very important cases like Ndindili Umana. John Philpott is one of the editors who successfully represented
one of the key accused, Mr. Z,
who was a member of the so-called Akazu, which were, according to the
allegedly a member of the
allegedly a member of the alleged Akazu, the little house, which allegedly organized the alleged organized genocide.
You know, that case is very, just to interrupt there for a moment, I mean, that is, I really hope people will look at that, because the term was thrown around as, by the way, I don't mind journalists, editorial writers, they just pick things up and sort of run it through their mouth and or put it on paper, there was the Akazu. But, you know, when it eventually became a courtroom matter, that then the question was, can you show me that there was an Akazu? And how do we... We have a prejudice that it existed, but actually, as Mr. Philpott convinced the court, there was no
such... He was not guilty.
The man was not guilty. And the other thing is that if he was a leading figure, they said, well, so what was he doing? And then they were able to track his movements and say, he was here, he was there, etc. He obviously wasn't leading anything. I mean, you know, if he was in a car trying to get out of the country, that's not the leader of a major military force. You know, if he's knocking on the door of a foreign embassy saying, let me in, they're trying to kill me, that's not a leader. You know, that sort of phenomena.
I think the importance of the book actually is on the dust jacket itself. I mean, it starts off as saying an aura of respectability hovers over international criminal tribunals. And I think this goes some way to shine some light on that aura and dispose of it. I mean, there's some truly terrific essays, including an essay by one Phil Taylor. I'm not just saying that because I want to come back on the show again.
Yes.
But it's called The ICTR is War.
I am related to that, Phil.
You're right. Yes, intimately.
Yes.
Ramsey Clark, which is a really terrific historical summary of what the ICTR is all about. And
but it's certainly been a long learning experience, and it was supposed to launch us into this wonderful new era with an international criminal court. Now, by the way, I want to mention a name, Michael Mandel, because he was someone that you were a student of and worked with over the years. He was an early skeptic about this phenomenon and wrote rather profoundly. Do you want to outline his views on this court?
Right. I do have a paper in here called How the International Criminal Law Movement Undermined International Criminal Law, Michael Mandel's Groundbreaking Analysis. So I don't want to give too much away. I just want to leave enough so that people will want to go and buy the book and read about it. But more seriously, Michael Mandel, I was going to write something about it, but when I looked closely at his analysis, it's quite a profound analysis of how we got from there to here. And I suppose it starts off this way. At the end of World War II, the world was righteously and rightfully sickened by war, and so there was an international peace treaty, and that treaty is called the United Nations Charter. And under the United Nations Charter, the whole goal of that is to rid the world of the scourge of law, and it says that in the preamble to the Charter. And so the regime that came out after World War II was a regime which essentially outlawed war and sought to, more or less successfully, maybe less in some circumstances, but as a matter of legality, the only way a nation could go to war against another nation was one in self-defense. That's little understood. It means that you can defend yourself as a nation if another nation's armies are sort of about to pour over your borders. And according to the United Nations Charter, which we've signed and we agree to, the once we have the situation sort of started off, we've started off defending ourselves, the UN then has to take over and control the defense, the self-defense, because it's in the interest of humanity that it's done properly and that aggressors are discouraged. Mm-hmm. That's one. The only other way that one nation can go to war against the other is with the approval of the Security Council of the United Nations, acting under Chapter 7, where there is a threat to international peace and security, which the United Nations has not been able to deal with through peaceful means, that is, diplomacy, sanction, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. At the end of the Cold War, the United States was left with a bit of a headache because they wanted to start changing, not that they hadn't done it before, but they wanted to seriously get around the business of changing regimes they didn't like. Starting with Yugoslavia, they wanted to get rid of the state of Yugoslavia. They wanted the change of regime. They did not like the government of Milosevic. They didn't like the multinational left-wing government that was before that. But to attack Yugoslavia without a self-defense rationale and without a rationale of without the Security Council allowing it was illegal. And according to the protocols that exist at the end of World War II wasn't just illegal, it was the worst international war crime. And Michael liked to quote from the Michael Mandel, the Nuremberg Principles. The Nuremberg Principles set out three war crimes: crimes against the peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. The crimes against the peace, Principle 4, was included the planning, preparation, initiation of a war of aggression. And the Nuremberg Tribunal declared that the initiation of a war of aggression isn't only an international crime, but the supreme international crime, differing from other international war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. Mm-hmm. So the war of aggression, which was fought by NATO against Yugoslavia, was widely viewed by legal scholars as illegal, and in fact, the supreme war crime. So the U.S. wanted to do something, the U.S. and the whole of the NATO countries, wanted to do something about this to change the legality which emerged from World War II. They said, well, we're fighting this under the rubric of humanitarian intervention. But, I mean, the people who put together the U.N. Charter and the Nuremberg tribunals, the Nuremberg Principles, would be horrified by that because it would have sounded Hitlerian, because that's exactly what Hitler said. He was intervening in Poland for humanitarian reasons.
Same with Czechoslovakia.
And same with Czechoslovakia, that's right.
And Mussolini in Italy.
That's right. So
he was going to put an end to slavery in Ethiopia.
So he said, well, no.
The least he could do.
You can't do that. State sovereignty is all important, and that's not going to happen. So what they do is they created a series of tribunals, some of which somewhat preexisted the Yugoslav intervention, like the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, whose president, whose first president, Antonio Cassese, the late Antonio Cassese, an international law scholar from Italy, said that the NATO attack on Yugoslavia was illegal. Said it was illegal. What they did, and what's kind of clever about all of the international criminal tribunals, including the ICC, is that the one crime they can't touch, they're not allowed to touch, is the crime against the peace. So for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia...
They turned it upside down.
They turned it upside down. So when Michael Mandel tested them, along with myself and some others, and tried to get an indictment against...
You actually sat in the room with Carla Del Ponte and tried to convince her, right?
I did. She was flanked by two legal advisors, two lawyers, one, both from NATO countries, one from Canada, one from Scotland, who said that, yes, quite clearly, because they couldn't prosecute NATO, because the question of their illegal attack on Yugoslavia was beyond their jurisdiction.
Mm.
But, by the way, I mean, so the problem becomes...
So war is no longer a crime.
War is no longer a crime. So what about the killing of civilians and so on by NATO forces, by dropping of bombs and so on? Well, that's justified by saying, well, they're in a war. But that's a twisted justification. Even if you can't prosecute the war, you can't defend yourself by saying, I can kill people because I'm involved in an illegal war. And the same thing bled over into the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, where the prosecution wouldn't prosecute, and to this day will not prosecute, the people who started the conflagration in Rwanda, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, for example, invaded the country, or when they assassinated the president, Habyarimana, which everyone agrees started the worst of the killings.
Well, I said majority of people believe.
Yes. I think the majority of people. That's right. The prosecution of the ICTR said variously, well, we don't investigate plane crashes.
Yes.
This was part of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it begs the question of whether the war was legal or illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the brilliance of Michael's being able to synthesize all of this is he said, look, the international criminal courts are essentially there to do propaganda for the war makers. Mm-hmm. Much as it's attractive, and it's certainly attractive to lots of people to think, okay, you know, we're going to have an international criminal court, it'll go after the bad guys. It's a very seductive idea. But in doing so, in picking on, and it invariably picks on Africans, or in the case of Yugoslavia, the losing side.
Yeah, by the way, I want to make sure we come to that, and I'm going to just tell people the title of this book is Justice Belied, The Unbalanced Scales of International Criminal Justice. That's barakabooks.com. We're speaking to David Jacobs, who has one of the essays in the book. And that does bring us to this idea of the ICC was supposed to be the gold standard of international justice. And we have a situation where it's been in existence 10, 11 years, and prosecuted only Africans.
Only Africans. Only Africans, and only Africans in countries where Western countries have, or may have, material material interests. And they've done it, this has been the pattern. The International Criminal Tribunal's indictments form propaganda for the West to engage in regime change in various countries, either directly by bombing the living hell out of them, as they did in Libya, or indirectly by funding groups and so on who are going to overthrow those governments, and they can portray it propagandistically as, well, the governments are run by war criminals. So, mm-hmm. for example, the ICC took it upon themselves to issue an indictment against Libyan President Gaddafi and his sons in the middle of the NATO war on Libya. Well, I mean, you know, supporters of the ICC, when they say, well, that's fair enough, and, you know, we wanted to get Gaddafi and so on.
Yes.
Although, it's in the middle of that war, providing something of a justification for a war against somebody that the ICC, with all his prestige, has said is a war criminal.
You remember, by the way, that one of the charges was that he was distributing Viagra to his soldiers so they could rape women. That was yeah. They said that with a straight face.
I mean, it begs
that was the chief prosecutor.
It begs all kinds of jokes, but they're terribly bad taste.
Like the ICC is a joke.
Exactly. But Michael wrote himself that after the war against Libya had ended, and those indictments had served their purpose in justifying the war, the International Criminal Court handed the prosecution of Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, to the Libyan authorities. So at the end of the war, that job had been done. They didn't care anymore. So they said, okay, we'll give back to the new Libyan authorities.
By the way, my understanding is he never actually ended up in their hands. He's still being held by one particular sectarian group.
Yes, it's my understanding. I think that's right. And, of course, it's the horror of... there's two endorsements of the NATO attack. The one endorsement is by indicting NATO's victims, and the other is by burnishing the new government, such as it is, assuming there is a government, by saying, okay, now you can prosecute. We're going to hand him over to you. I mean, it's
for target practice.
Target, exactly. And then now we have the current farce of the intended prosecution of the sitting Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, which is collapsing as we speak, because the prosecution proceeded...
The case is collapsing.
The case is collapsing because the prosecution proceeded without evidence. It's a shocking thing. And the prosecution now, in the form of the chief prosecutor, Madam Bensouda, comes to the world and says, oh, well, the problem is the government of Kenya isn't helping us out. So you imagine a prosecution going on in Canada which says, well, we're going to pick on you, but you've got to help us. You've got to give us the evidence to convict you, you know. There's no presumption of innocence whatsoever here. Apart from the fact the Attorney General of Kenya has gone and said, we've given you what we've got. Mm-hmm. The widespread view in Africa, very widespread. I mean, African presidents across the political spectrum are saying this is simply a colonial effort to try and teach Africans how to behave. It's a throwback.
To undermine regimes, in the case of Kenyatta, they were going to remove him and put him in prison if they could, so that his party could not be the leader of Kenya.
Yeah. He's quoted Uhuru Kenyatta just a few days ago when he returned from The Hague as saying, let me tell those who think solutions to Kenya's problems will come from where they're taking us. They should know solutions for Kenya will be found in this Kenya that belongs to us. They'll come from Kenyans themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I
would think that would resonate for any patriot.
Well, Charles Taku, Chief Taku, who was a very distinguished defense lawyer and a very expert one, has called him an unlikely hero. He's emerging as Africa's star. And people are worried, of course, now that the Kenyatta case, because of the way it's collapsing, is going to be handed over to the Assembly of State Parties, which is sort of the General Assembly.
Well, the Western powers tried to negate the outcome of a Kenyan election by saying he has to set this matter aside to being elected and fight his case in The Hague. Fortunately, the Kenyan population and the leadership fought that off, and they didn't let a situation develop where he was a quasi-president.
Right.
And that was a close call because all the editorial writers, and to this day, are saying, you've got to get him, as though they know he's guilty. They don't live in Kenya. They don't have any reporters in Kenya, but they know he's guilty.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to the extent we understand what happened in Kenya, there appears to be, at least the Kenyans, and lots of other people say that Odinga, who was the opponent of Kenyatta, was supplied with a lot of money and other things from the West. And when the election results were announced, it was Odinga's supporters that went into the streets and created violence because they were unhappy about the result and so on. Mm-hmm. So the problem at the end of the day, Mandel wrote, and I quoted it in my article, that if the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is to survive, and it badly wants to survive, it will continue to ignore the crimes of the U.S. and to round up the usual suspects, to regulate but not prohibit, and indeed to legitimate the use of violence in international affairs. And that's the problem with all these international criminal tribunals. That is what they do by demonizing the victims. I mean,
Yes, if he's a criminal, you can bomb him.
If he's a criminal, you can bomb him. And to go back to the Yugoslav War, it was in the middle of the Yugoslav, the NATO attack in Yugoslavia, when there was enthusiasm for the attack was flagging, that the prosecutor went public with the what was then the secret indictment of Milosevic, so in an effort essentially to say that, well, you can't negotiate. There was an attempt to negotiate peace.
That prosecutor actually said you can't negotiate with him. He's a war criminal.
Yeah, well, that's right.
So obviated any peace arrangement.
That's right. Even the prosecution assigned to NATO the task of pursuing the people that the ICTY prosecution wanted to indict.
Yes.
So here you have a situation where you're turning a blind eye to the illegality of the war itself, and you're asking the aggressors to help out in rounding up
and implementing victims. International law. For
that's
you,
right.
Yes.
That's right. And again, Mandel made the wonderfully simple point that forget about all these international criminal tribunals, which everyone, human rights organizations, seems to be so excited. The goal is stop the wars in the first place.
Yes.
Not justify them and intensify them as they're going on.
Yes. Well, by the way, this is important in light of what's developing in with Syria, Iraq today. I notice United Nations ambassadors are on their feet saying Syria is a sovereign country, and you haven't made a case and in this body to act in an aggressive way or occupy their territory or airspace. And it speaks right to this matter, because they're going to be claiming that Assad is a war criminal to permit them to make war.
If I recall correctly, I hope I do, I think one of the last radio interviews, maybe the last radio interview that Michael Mandel mm-hmm. did was an interview on your show.
Yes.
About what looked like the impending attack on Syria.
Yes, one year ago.
At that time.
It's almost the anniversary.
Yes. I mean, yeah, that's right. I mean, but by any measure, in the legality which was formed internationally with the support of the United States and France and Great Britain then the Soviet Union and China, the end of World War II, and the international community were all signatories to the UN Charter. The idea of attacking a sovereign country like Syria in order to allegedly root out a terrorist outfit like ISIS would be laughable if it were not so criminally illegal. It is
yes.
a war of aggression. Nobody could tolerate that. I mean, if there was a
sovereignty of states is supposed to be the sacrosanct.
Yeah,
Canada
I mean,
insists on its sovereignty. They told de Gaulle to go home when he made the wrong speech. Every country reserves that right.
That's right. If everybody behaved the way the U.S. And unfortunately Canada is now behaving in the Middle East, mm-hmm. and wanted to go around attacking what they at least allegedly perceived to be their enemies, you're talking about a war of all against all.
Yes.
Thomas Hobbes said that.
Yes. Well, Thomas Hobbes, perfect conclusion.
David
Jacobs, who is
Thank
one
you.
Of the authors of Justice Belied, The Unbalanced Scales of International Criminal Justice, BarakaBooks.com. David, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And you're listening to The Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I want to tell everybody that Richard Williams is coming to Toronto. Richard Williams is the author of an important book, a story of his life, and he's the father of Venus and Serena Williams. He's going to be at the Black and Caribbean Book Affair on November the 8th, 2014, of course, October the 8th, at 4 p.m. at the William Dew Auditorium. And he will present his book and speak about his life and give his thoughts on the Ferguson shooting and the ensuing protests. You remember he was going to be here about a month and a half ago, but he just did the right thing. He went to be part of the effort around the trying to achieve some justice in Ferguson, Missouri, which he's got. That's a steep hill to climb. And he will be, you can find the book at a different book list, Friday, Black November 7, 2014. So he'll be there at 11 a.m. And he'll be signing his book at a different book list. And that's November the 7th at 11 a.m. And we're really glad he's going to be coming to town. And to talk about coming to town, make sure that you start supporting CIUT because it's our membership drive and the new sound of the city. You can go to CIUT.fm and become a member, and it'll say to you in what show do you support. And the answer is the Taylor Report. By the way, if you're wondering who to support in the upcoming elections, I would tell you that don't listen to polls. Voting and polls are two different things. Voting is not a poll, and a poll is often a way to manipulate voting. But thinking about this city and how it's developed and what its values are, if you're really in a conundrum, just ask yourself, what would Jack Layton do? And then do that.